everybody. Gregory Conley here with another edition of the Your Video Store Shelf podcast here at yourvideostoreshelf.com. Joining us on the show today is our first repeat guest. When I had him on the show 9.5 months ago for our sixth show, I had said at the end, we're going to get you on real soon to discuss the further end of your career. Well, end is not the correct word, but the furthering of your career. And that part of his career has been the writing and eventual production of over 26 movies. And I am glad to welcome that man to the show today. Steve Latshaw, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. It's a nice day.
Great. Yeah, how is it in L.A., actually?
It's sunny, but nice and cool. So.
Same way, actually, here in New Jersey, which is not something that usually gets connected to L.A. Yesterday, when I was doing interviews, I was actually sweating. But today, nice and cool.
Well, where would you like to begin?
Well, I think first off, for those people who were not fortunate enough to hear the wisdom of Steve Latshaw 9.5 months ago, let's hear about what we covered last time. For the most part, you were on to promote your last film, Stan Lee's Lightspeed, which was a Sci-Fi Channel movie. But for the other half hour or so of that show, we talked about your directorial career in good old Florida. So let's hear a bit about that.
Well, we did started making films in Florida, the ultra-low-budget films, in 1990 with a film called Vampire Trailer Park, which is a horror comedy I produced with a partner of mine, Pat Moran. And then Pat and I, on the basis of that, Fred Ray did not want to distribute it, but we knew Fred, and on the basis of that film, he was interested. He saw something there, and he was interested in financing some films in Florida as a producer. And we met with him in 1992 out in L.A., and he agreed to finance a movie, which we had called Swamp Monster. It later was released as Dark Universe. That did very well. He immediately financed another one, which became Biohazard, the Alien Force, and then a third film, which became Jacko. We did all three of those in a row, and they all did very well. And then it was at that point, I think around 95, that I had made the decision to move to California. And I did one more film in Florida, a horror film called Death Mask, that used a lot of the same crew that we used on the movies for Fred, but was a film. It was basically a work for hire. I literally did not really have any control over the script or the casting. I basically came in and called action for 12 days. It was a project that was controlled by the producer's writer star, an actor named James Best, and his company did that. And I showed up with my crew, and as a result, I got paid to direct the thing, so that's how that worked. And then after I finished that, I was offered a film by Jim Wynorski that he was producing called Sorceress 2 that I was supposed to direct in the summer. Jim wanted it done in Florida. I wrote an outline, which he approved. I started putting the casting and the crew together, and then at the last minute, I found out from another source that Jim did not have the rights to the project, and they were going to make it in California, so I was out of the picture. Although the irony was, they did make it in Florida, or in California. The guy that made the film hasn't done much since, so my sympathies rest with him. And oddly enough, the AFM flyer that they used to pre-sell the movie still lists me as the director of the film. But that would have been my first foray into what they call erotic thrillers, but that was not to be. But I elected to move out to California anyway.
Did you ever get the chance to have a foray into the erotic thriller genre?
No, I remember at one point early on when I was talking to Andrew about both writing and directing for him when I was working with Royal Oaks, and at the time, Royal Oaks was doing a lot of low-budget family and erotic films, and I remember at one point Andrew asking me if I wanted to quote-unquote do a donkey movie, which was their name for the erotics, and I told him I'd much rather direct a family film, and so that's kind of where we left it. Ironically, I think Andrew's nom de plume on those films was producer Don Bonkey. So that was.
Did anyone ever explain the meaning behind the donkey term? Is it just the connection to ass?
I assume that's the connection. I've heard the phrase "doing the donkey."
Ah.
Connection. There's all sorts of wonderful verbal puns with all these films. I think the production company was called Palm Entertainment, and it for the erotics, and it took me a while to figure out what that meant, and then of course it was very funny. And I know Andrew's nom de plume on a lot of these shows as producer is Hugh, H-U-G-H, second word, J-A-N-U-S, which if you pronounce rapidly is Hugh Janus. So, you know, that's...
And I think it was when you were on the show that I mentioned that my Netflix envelopes always come to me as Hugh Janus, and as a result, whenever I call up Netflix when I have a problem, they actually address me as Hugh Janus.
Anything we do to perpetuate that name, I think, is important. But
mm-hmm.
That was basically it. I moved to California in the fall of 1995, and it was right at the moment where the market for low-budget, ultra-low-budget, below $100,000 features in California had died. So despite my best efforts into trying to set up various deals, I didn't work for almost a year. There was no one cared that I'd made these films in Florida. No one, if you could walk into somebody's office and say, hey, I can make this movie for $50,000 in 12 days, they say, well, we don't want a 12-day, $50,000 movie. So so I didn't work. I spent a year trying to set up deals and just, you know, questioning whether or not I should have moved down.
And was that really disheartening for that year?
Well, you see, when I came out of here, I was 35 years old, and I felt like I had been running a marathon race since the age of 25 to get into the film business. And it was sort of like, wow, I'm here, but gosh, I'm really, really tired. And shell-shocked, and I thought I'd prepared myself for what California was going to be like or what L.A. was going to be like. And no matter how much you prepare yourself for it, when you get here, you're not prepared. It's always tougher than you imagine. But as Fred always told me, you know, sooner or later you're going to have to come out here and take your lumps like the rest of us. I remember running into Dave Dakota at a Christmas party at Royal Oaks about a year after I moved out here, and he pulled me aside and he says, listen, I'm glad to see you're out here, but I just hope you know what you're walking into. And so there was a lot of that. You know, there was a lot of ominous phrases like, you know, if you can't make it in this business in 2 years, you better head home and stuff like that. So it was all intimidating, particularly because I had a 10-year-old kid and, you know, the whole bit.
And I guess after that year, your luck changed and you wound up running into the Invisible Dad project. Am I correct?
Out of the blue, Fred came to my rescue again, mentored me again. Out of the blue, he said, I'm doing a family movie called Invisible Dad. I'm doing it for Andrew Stevens. Would you like to write it? I'd co-written a couple of scripts with Pat Moran on the previous shows, and I figured, well, I didn't come out here to be a writer, but, well, you know, and the price was not huge, the fee, but it was a fee. I was being paid to do this, so I sat down and wrote a family script, and the script that I wrote, everybody really, really liked. And they made the film. The film turned out exactly the way they wanted it to turn out. And Andrew promptly approached me with another project. He says, I'm doing an action film, space shuttle adventure movie. We've had a script written. It's called Scorpio One. We don't like the script. Can you rewrite it? So I read it. Looked it over, and I told him, I said, look, I don't know that I can rewrite this script, but I can write you a space shuttle movie that I think would be a very good story. And I pitched it. It was basically sort of a reversed take on an old Alistair MacLean novel called Ice Station Zebra, and you know, with a few twists and turns and some surprises. And I wrote that script as Scorpio One, and hit pay dirt with that. Andrew absolutely loved that script. He had I think the star it was Jeff.
Good old Jeff Speakman.
Jeff Speakman and Robert Carradine. Carradine said it was the best first draft he'd ever read when he signed to play the part of a space nerd in the film. And, you know, that's no small shakes coming from a guy who's worked with Sam Fuller. So
yeah, really.
Yeah, so that movie turned out really well. It was kind of my first big movie that was 35mm, that was more than $1 million to make, and I really enjoyed the experience. And based on that film, folks, they decided I was their go-to guy for military action stuff, of which they were doing a lot of at the time. I know William Martell was writing stuff for him at that time, and so I kind of got in on that territory, and that was pretty cool.
Did you have any prior experience looking at anything militarily, or was it just you had watched a lot of military movies in your past, and that was enough
to... I watched a lot of war movies with my dad. I was always into that kind of entertainment. A close friend of mine is a Ranger, an Army Ranger. He's been a friend since we were both 8 years old. He's actually in Iraq, and he would regularly call me and talk about the various films that we did that were military in origin, and he would go, you know, Steve, this is bullshit. He'd always correct me, and I'd always have to say, look, it's only a movie. The point is, I think the dialogue, you want to get it accurate, but at this level, when you're writing so fast, you just want to try to make it sound as authentic as possible and not make the obvious mistakes. But
well, then, how about this question? Oh, I was just going to ask, what's the fastest that you've written one of these scripts in, and what's the average time?
Average, I would usually, I think the average has usually been, I'd spend a week putting together the character breakdown and a detailed step outline to make sure all the beats were where they were supposed to be and know where I was. A blueprint for the script, and then about 3 weeks to write it, to get a first draft that I could turn in. The fastest I ever did a project was for a movie called, it came out on video as The Last Siege. Ernie Hudson and Jeff Fahey. This, again, was a rewrite job. I read the script. The script was not good, and so I said, I've got to start at page one. And the storyline was to involve an American senator that had been kidnapped and put on a train, or the train was kidnapped by terrorists. The American senator was trapped on the train. The terrorists had a nuclear device. Senator was played by Ernie Hudson. The ATF agent sent to rescue him, also on the train, was played by Jeff Fahey. And I told the producer, Kim Ray, I said, I have to rewrite this. And she said, fine. But keep in mind, Jeff and Ernie are not real friendly, and you need to limit them to two scenes that have to be very brief, and we'll see you in 5 days. So I did that one in 5 days, and that was tough. That was 5 days of hell.
I can imagine. And I should note that as per Ernie Hudson, I believe it was last July that I spoke to him, Jeff and he had their fight of sorts on Operation Delta Force, the new Image film, and that spat continued for a couple of years, but thankfully they sort of patched things up because Ernie learned that Jeff's mother was sick during the filming of Operation Delta Force, and that was what had caused the problem between the two of them.
Now was that Myrna Fahey, who was in Roger Corman movies back in the 60s? I think it I actually ran into Ernie Hudson a couple of years ago and had a discussion about him, and he kind of alluded to the same thing. So I certainly give Fahey, cut him some slack for his mood on that film. I'll certainly say he was very good in the movie. He was excellent in the film, and I've always thought he resembled Audie Murphy in his later years. I'd love to do a biopic someday and have Fahey play Murphy. But that was the toughest one, I think, schedule-wise. The toughest one,
and
I think, just to really interject briefly, story-wise, one of the toughest ones was a movie called Memorial Day, with another one with Jeff Speakman, and that was because Speakman was allowed to come up with a story, and the story kept changing, and it was a very tough collaboration, and the film didn't turn out that well.
I think I've only seen one of Jeff's films, and for some reason I've just never stumbled upon another one.
He's a good actor. I mean, he's, for what he does, he's very good.
And I think those early films, Scorpio 1 and Memorial Day, were Worth Keeter films, right?
Yes.
I think I spoke to Worth briefly. I think it was when Edward Albert had passed away.
I have not spoken to Worth. I actually live in the same town Worth does now, but I have not spoken to him in many, many years. I've not heard from him. We always got along very well. He was a very... Worth is a very, very much a Southern gentleman. Very, very nice guy. I really liked, really enjoyed working with him, particularly on Scorpio 1.
So, I guess, following The Invisible Dad and Scorpio 1 and Memorial Day, you had proved to yourself that you could go ahead and have 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and write a script that could be shot for a low amount of money. And what amount of money were we usually looking at for an Andrew Stevens Phoenician Films Royal Oaks production?
My fee?
Well, I don't think you want to reveal that, but the actual budget of the film, or
no,
what you aimed for.
These shows all averaged, depending on who you were with and how many people were in them. I think the range was somewhere between $1.5 million and $5 million, depending on what the project was. So it varied. I think in the $1.5 million range, $2 million range, I think a lot of these shows were. The schedules were short. They typically, I remember they were 18 days, and then it would be 16 days, and then it would be 14 days. But we did a bunch of them. We did Countermeasures. We did, as I said, Memorial Day. And then I got an agent, which caused me to not work for a year. At the end of about a year of working for Royal Oaks, I got an agent who was awful. The first thing he did was convince me that I should be making 5 or 6 times what I was making, which, you know, may very well be true, but the fact of the matter is there's a set fee that's budgeted at these shows that they're going to pay for a script, and that's just the way it is. And I was already at the high end of what I was getting, of what people were getting paid for these things. And he burned my bridges with Andrew Stevens' company. Although, at that time, Royal Oaks was basically dissolving anyway, so it wasn't really a major issue. But I remember the 1998, all I did was write a spec script called Divided We Stand, which was about militias. And my agent at the time was not able to set me up with any meetings and told me he couldn't sell the script because everybody in town had a malicious script. So that 98 was pretty much a lost year. And then in early 99, I kind of hooked up through Jim Wynorski and Fred, hooked up with Andrew again, and wrote a movie that Fred was going to direct called Active Stealth. And once again, it was they really liked the script. It was a chance for me to do a lot of my favorite World War II movie cliches in the film. Plus, it had, part of it was filmed at Corganville, which is an old Western location I'm very fond of. And on the basis of that, I got, I think, a 2 or 3 picture deal with Andrew's company, and I was back in business. And the script Divided We Stand that I had written for this agent, about 3 weeks after I fired him, I sold it to Cinetel. But that's another story.
What script was that? The U.S. SEAL script?
It was a movie called Divided We Stand. It was I'd gone in with Jim Wynorski to Cinetel. This was all in 1999, which was probably my biggest or most successful year. And I went into Cinetel with Jim. We pitched a story. Paul Hertzberg didn't want that story. And then I pitched this Militia script, and they really liked it, and they ended up making it as Militia with Dean Cain and Jennifer Beals and Stacy Keach and Fred Forrest.
And did you wind up doing some major rewrites on it so that it could fit into a Cinetel budget?
Yeah, it was written as this, you know, $80, $100 million action film, so we trimmed it down. That was the year where we were doing stock footage movies, so it was basically turn it into a stock footage movie. That was 1999 was a year we really started to go nuts with action movies with massive amounts of stock footage in them.
And I was going to ask about that because those stock footage action movies are actually one of the things that really got me interested in the direct-to-video industry itself and got me learning about why the stock footage needed to be there. And of course, now I know budget. The $2 million that people were making wasn't enough, obviously, to do many action scenes.
Let's say you got $1.5 million. That doesn't buy much time in Los Angeles, and it doesn't buy a lot of action. There was two ways of approaching it. The way Fred Ray approached stock footage was he would use the stock sequences to enhance a set piece that he was already doing. You know, whether it be extra explosions or a better climax to an action piece that he was shooting anyway. Jim Wynorski's approach to stock footage was very different. It was something of an art to Jim. What Jim would do, and what I ended up doing on all of the stock footage films I did with Jim, we would basically troll. We'd go to videos. We'd have a catalog of everything in Sony's library that they were licensing, everything in Universal's library, everything in MGM UA's library. And we would troll the films. We'd rent them, and we'd just put them on fast forward looking for action sequences. And once we found them, we would just write them into the film, and then it was cheaper to try to match costumes and cars and props and settings and have all the big action stuff come from stock footage rather than actually shoot it. And Jim was really a master at it. He took great pleasure in taking these scenes and trying to cut them seamlessly into our films. I remember after I started working for Andrew again, which at this time was Phoenician Entertainment / Franchise Pictures, Jim came to me with an outline for a film called Rangers. And he was filled with glee that every single set piece in the movie came from somebody else's film. That there wasn't a single bit of action in the whole film that was going to be shot by our unit. And he'd come to me with this outline. He'd actually written an outline, I think in one night, that basically incorporated all this stuff in this logistical plot. The plot involved a ranger mission to Iraq where they are supposed to rescue somebody, and one of the guys gets left behind, and then one of these rangers, the guy that gets left behind, joins forces with Arab terrorists, invades the United States with the purpose of getting one of their prisoners out, and it's this whole convoluted storyline, and But Jim had written this story, and so I had to try to make sense out of this. And it literally, it opens up with a 15 to 20 minute invasion of Iraq, or a nighttime mission to Iraq, which uses everything we could possibly use, from Navy SEALs, from
Delta Force.
And these guys, when they jump out of the plane and land and get in the boats, they're in Navy SEALs air uniforms. And when we get them on land, we cut to our guys, our actors, who change, I think, into Army Ranger outfits to go to the town in Iraq. And then when they're in the town in Iraq, they change into terrorist outfits so they can match the terrorists. And then after they do all their business, they change back into the SEALs uniforms to match the stock footage from Navy SEALs so that we can get them on the helicopter and get them safely home. And then from that point on, I think there was a car chase from the Hidden that we used, matched the late 80s car and the locations and sets perfectly. We used a boat explosion for something. We used massive chunks of footage from Invasion USA. We used the big amphibious invasion in Florida, all the footage of the trucks driving across the deep south at night, the big semis. We used the invasion of the armory and the theft of the armored cars from that movie. We used the big street battle in the streets of Atlanta from that movie. Massive chunks of stock footage. And then at the end, after the street battle in Atlanta's over, we have our two actors run out into the street. They get on city buses, and boom, we're into the climactic bus chase from Red Heat. So it really, the movie's almost a drinking game. You can sit there and try to figure out which movies all these shots are from. And it's a jaw-dropping film to look at. And Glenn Plummer and Matt McCoy are the stars of it. To top it off, the day before they were scheduled to start production, they realized they didn't have enough big star names in it to get any kind of decent distribution out of it. So Andrew called me and said, I need a geezer part, which is an older, established actor part. And so I wrote 10 pages of this senator. And ever so often, like an old Republic serial, the two leads would come to this senator in this park, like the scenes with Donald Sutherland at JFK. And they would meet with him, and they would kind of tell him what just happened, and he'd tell them what was going on and what to expect to happen next. They come to him like four times in the movie, and then at the end, this senator turns out to be the guy behind the whole thing. So that's how we tied him into the story. And they brought an actor named, he was on L.A. Law, Corbin Burns, and they brought him out for half a day. And shot.
I was just about to ask about Corbin, because I remember Jim making a joke. I don't know if it was on Ranger, the commentary track for Rangers or not, but he made the joke that when Corbin came, he left his car running.
Yeah, he's there 2.5 hours. I think he did all of his pages in 2.5 hours. And they're supposed to be in a park in Washington, D.C., and we also used some stock footage of a neighborhood getting blown up at night from Invasion USA in that movie. It was supposed to be in Washington, D.C., the park was, but it was actually shot at a park down in L.A. where Laurel and Hardy made a very famous short, I believe called Men of War, where they're sailors on leave and they take girlfriends out in little boats on this pond. And there's palm trees everywhere. So it's obviously not Washington, but that movie's really amazing to see. It's in cutout bins. Last time I saw one, it was in a cutout bin at a Fry's. But it's worth seeing just for all the stock footage.
It really is, and that pretty much represents the height of stock footage absurdity. other than, did you ever get to use the Terminator 2 footage that Fred got to use, I think, twice?
Yes, Fred used it in
His Treat Williams nuclear power plant movie.
He used it in that, and he also, I think, used some of it. I think he had to reshoot it, though, for Japan wouldn't take it. If I'm not mistaken, he had to reshoot it for Japan. But Wynorski, that was the footage that we were all a little worried about, because Wynorski used it in Militia over at Senatel.
Yeah, that was it.
Used it heavily. And because Jim is shameless. I mean, he'll use... He took, for a movie he did for Senatel called Stealth Fighter, he took every single aerial action set piece from the movie Flight of the Intruder and threw them all into the first 15 minutes of that movie and shot pilot sequences with Costas Mandalore, I think, and Ice-T. And
yeah, he was in that.
Used, you know, cockpit shots of them, but basically the first 15 minutes of this Paramount movie, and it was produced by Mace Newfield. And the legend is that Mace Newfield was watching Cinemax in like a Vegas hotel room one night, and Stealth Fighter, Jim Stealth comes on TV, and he watches the core of his Flight of the Intruder film in the first 15 minutes of this new Senatel movie, and he apparently went ballistic. And supposedly that's one of the reasons why we were no longer able to get stock footage from Paramount. I don't know if that's true, but Jim just used everything. I think two of the craziest moments I remember stock footage-wise was there was a movie called Extreme Limits with Treat Williams. And at the time, Phoenician Royal Oaks was doing a movie with who's the guy who directed Speed? Was it Speed?
I have IMDb right in front of me. John DeBont.
That's not
did Speed.
Who directed Driven? Well, Rennie Harlan. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so Rennie Harlan's at Franchise. He's directing a big-budget Sylvester Stallone movie for Andrew and Ely Samaha called Driven. Okay? In the meantime, we're shooting Extreme Limits, which is a spy airplane disaster movie from with Treat Williams. And we're using the plane hijack and plane crash from the Stallone mountain climbing movie, Cliffhanger. We're using the air rescue helicopter from Cliffhanger. We're using the entire explosive Niagara Falls climax from
Long Kiss Goodnight.
So half this friggin' movie that we're making has been directed by Rennie Harlan. It's like we're doing this tribute film to him. Because our whole ending is Long Kiss Goodnight, and the bulk of the rest of it is Cliffhanger, right down to the plane crash and everything. And it was funny. I went on the set of this film, and we were using a long sequence where an SUV is chased down a mountain by a helicopter armed with machine guns. It came from a movie called Narrow Margin with Gene Hackman. And I'm talking to Treat Williams, and he says, you know, you're the writer, huh? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, you know, I really like that mountain chase sequence. And I said, well, thank you. And he goes, I really like the film it came from, too. And he kind of winked. And Jim did the very same thing with a movie called Gale Force with Treat. The entire opening of that are the three major action set pieces from the Last Action Hero. There's a house explosion, a car chase, which shows a car going through neighborhoods and getting chased by a red pickup truck that's machine gunning it, firing rockets, and eventually driving off a bridge in Pasadena. And that was really surreal because Treat was dressed in Schwarzenegger's red T-shirt.
I was just about to mention that, how ridiculous he looked.
Tan jacket, rawhide jacket, and the car. And Jim had also managed to duplicate the red pickup that the bad guys were in. So pretty amazing stuff.
And, God, that was one hell of a monologue there, Steve.
Sorry.
No. That was with all seriousness. That was nice to sit back. And around that time, pseudonyms were big, but not for the usual reasons. Fred and Jim both took various pseudonyms, not because they didn't like the movies, but because Andrew didn't want to make it seem like the truth, where he had two different directors doing five movies a year, or three movies, four movies a year, whatever the exact figure was. And you took, according to the IMDb, which is correct about 10% of the time, pseudonyms on two films. You took the Patricia McHugh pseudonym on Gale Force and Stranded, which
yes.
was released as Black Horizon.
Yes. Bandrew came to me. A lot of the same German buyers were buying these films. And they specifically came to Andrew and said, we want you to use a different writer. We keep seeing this Steve Latshaw show up on so many of these films. Find a different writer, perhaps a woman. And so Andrew called me and he goes, on the next script, you're a woman. Find a woman writing man, because he wanted to continue to use me, which was nice. He's always done his best to keep me employed. And so I used, at the time, it's my now ex-wife's maiden name, and I was under the mistaken impression that by using her name on a couple of these shows, I would satisfy the Germans, I would still get paid, and it might give her an ego boost enough to where it might smooth over some of the wrinkles in our marriage.
Ouch.
Apparently, I think after she filed for divorce about a year after Black Horizon was done, so I'm assuming maybe it didn't work. Maybe she saw the films, I don't know. But, yeah, that's her name.
I can just imagine in the divorce papers, client sullied my good name by attaching it to two of his movies.
It was very weird because she would actually show off the DVD at parties. She like, by God, there's my name. I'm taking credit for it. So, it was a funny little thing that we did. But it was, you know, that's why we did it, because Andrew wanted to use Andrew's approach to all of this. He told me once, he said, look, because I'd tried to do something innovative in a family script of all things, when you're really supposed to stay on program, and I was doing a couple of twists, and he said, look, save the innovations for your spec scripts. You got to understand, we're not making movies here, we're making sausage. Meaning, stick to the formula, stick to the beats that the buyers want to have in these films. And so Andrew's approach was always, the best thing for you to be as a writer was dependable. If you could turn in something that was good enough to be broken down, was good enough to send out to casting agents, was good enough to budget, and quickly, then you would continue to work, because dependability was important for him. He I think all these producers are the same way, because I've worked for him, I've worked for New Image, I've worked for Cinetel, and it's always, does the writer get it? Get what we're trying to do here? And I think that's what it sort of boiled down to.
And on that note, we're just about out of time. But before we go, let's hear about the upcoming movies that we spoke about last time. You have, first, there is American Black Beauty. Has that premiered yet?
American Black Beauty has been out on video for about a year.
Oh.
I think they actually had a deal with Walmart, so that's the easiest place to find it. Lightspeed is out on DVD now. Xenophobia and Planet Raptor, which were both shot in 2005, will be out probably in the next couple of months. They'll probably show up on the Sci-Fi Channel first. I am currently in the middle of two projects, actually three projects. I've just completed an action-adventure script that's actually being shopped to some major outlets right now, so I'm very excited about that. It's a script I wrote with my old partner, Pat Moran, and I'm very excited about that because that has theatrical potential with the people that we're talking to. I just finished another action script for Andrew Stevens that's going to be shot probably in Romania this summer, and I'm right now in the middle of actually collaborating with Dolph Lundgren on an action film that's going to be done in Russia. So,
awesome.
It's been a busy year.
You've managed to, in the past, I think partly because of market conditions and partly because of that dependability, you've moved up from directing those movies. I don't remember how much we said the budgets were, but extremely low, and now you're into the Dolph Lundgren action territory, which is a hell of a lot more money.
Well, I think Dolph, you got to keep in mind that Dolph is, first of all, he's kept himself in shape, which a lot of these guys haven't. Dolph is also very smart. I mean, he's an MIT graduate. When I say I'm collaborating with him, normally with an actor, it's sort of like they have an idea for a film, and you write it, and they'll call it a collaboration. But he handed me a story that was so detailed and so laid out that literally it's half written. And so I've really enjoyed working with him. He's not probably – a lot of these guys are still huge in various markets around the world. And while they may not – you may not see a lot of – new Dolph Lundgren movies in theaters, they're still huge around the world, although I suspect this one might head that way because it's different and unique. But Seagal is still huge overseas, which is why I think Andrew's producing a lot of those films.
And you said earlier that Lundgren kept himself in shape. I just want to say that Seagal has kept himself in shape. It's just the cinematographers, they all have something against him. They add lenses on that add 50 pounds.
I wouldn't know. I've never met Seagal. Dolph is a couple of years older than I am and looks about 15 years younger than I do. So I know he's certainly kept himself in better shape than I have. I've worked with Jean-Claude Van Damme on a movie called that came out as In Hell. A lot of these guys. Michael Dudikoff,
And we're going to discuss the likes of Jean-Claude Van Damme and even Dolph Lundgren in the classic film Agent Red the next time we get you on the show. Hopefully, it'll be to promote something. So hopefully, Xenophobia and Planet Raptor, the sequel to Raptor Island, which, by the way, is out on DVD now. Hopefully, those will premiere soon, so we'll get you back on the show.
Right.
Steve? I want to thank you for coming on. Everybody else can check out Steve's IMDb, go through, check your local video store, see what they have, and check them out, especially if they have the commentary tracks on them that will teach you more about the industry than this show could do in a week. Steve, thanks again for coming on.
My pleasure.
And we will talk to you again soon. This is Greg Conley with the Your Video Store Shelf podcast. Thanks for listening, and I will talk to you soon.